Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. It's good to have you all with us here today. And let me just go through our day in history, September the 18th, and what happened on this day in history. This is the day that Greta Garbo, the great actress, was born in 1905. This is the day that my former student, now a great actress on her own, was born, Jada Pinkett Smith, in 1971. And this is the day in 1970 that Jimi Hendrix died at 27 years old. And we're going to play a lot of Jimi Hendrix and going in and out of our breaks today to remember Jimi Hendrix, one of my personal favorites, and can't miss that. This is the day that the native folks in Honduras discovered Christopher Columbus in 1502. And this is the day that the cornerstone was laid for the Capitol in 1793. George Washington laid the cornerstone for what became the U.S. Capitol building. More importantly, in 1850, as part of the Compromise of 1850, this is the day that Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Law that led to the other September 11th, 1851, that happened here in Maryland, Pennsylvania, that became the greatest conspiracy trial in the history of the United States, called the Christiana Rebellion, that took place when Gorsuch, who was a slave master in Baltimore County, went to retrieve his slaves, led to a shootout and a battle with a man who had been a slave and freed and ran with Frederick Douglass to freedom, and led to the largest conspiracy trial in the history of America around the Fugitive Slave Act, a very important piece of history we do not study. This is the day in 1851, the New York Daily Times became out for the first issue, later became the New York Times. This was the day that in 1895 that Booker T. Washington delivered the Atlanta Exposition Address at a business convention. And it was because of his viewpoints, this is where the notion of the Atlantic Compromise came from with Booker T. Washington. And this is the day that Fritz Pollard in 1919 became the first African-American to play professional football with the Akron Indians. And also was the first African-American ever to play in the Rose Bowl. On this day, in 1945, 1,000 students in Gary, Indiana, white students, protested integration, boycotted school, walked out of school. There were disturbances like this all through the North that day, in Chicago and all the kind of major metropolitan areas of our country. This is the day in 1960 that Fidel Castro went to New York City with the Cuban delegation to the UN after he had won the revolution and stirred the indignation, and people got upset by it, climaxed a speech on December 26th at the UN. And it's a day that I saw. I wasn't at the UN, but I was there outside the Hotel Teresa when he was there. Welcoming Fidel to this country as kind of a hero to a lot of young civil rights workers for winning his revolution in Cuba. This is also a day, and we'll conclude here, that Jimmy Carter filed a report with the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomenon and claiming he had seen a UFO, October 1969. It was the beginning of our UFO search in America under President Jimmy Carter. And in 1980, Arnold Tamayo became the first man of African descent to be sent on a mission in space. He was a Cuban and went with a Russian ship. He was the first person of African descent to go. And this is when, 1985, Ronald Reagan said that the SDI, strategic defense weapons, which are those missiles we were supposed to stop missiles with that no could figure while we were doing it, would not be part of our negotiations with the Russians. This was a day, an important thing in 2006. Simon Bikindi, who was one of the kind of great singers and musicians out of Rwanda, was put on trial for citing violence in relation to the genocides that killed 800,000 people. And this is the year 2007. Ukraine announced plans to cover a large-scale covering over a radioactive site of Chernobyl. There are still problems with Chernobyl and what's going on with people in the aftermath of that explosion, as there are now in Japan, which still, when you look at the map, see the red glowing still from the nuclear waste and fallout from that disaster. And now we're going to talk about our own country and where we're going in this world with our three guests and you at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook page. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. And in the studio here, E.R. Schiff is back with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, journalist in residence, and associate professor of journalism at Morgan State University at the Global School of Journalism, about to be christened on October the 9th.
October 3rd.
Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, assistant professor of American Studies at UMBC, author of Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Black Politics, Body Politics in Africana Communities, and Dr. Richard Vats, Rick Vats, professor, in the Department of Mass Communications, sorry, Rick, and Communication Studies.
Now Instructional Leadership and Professional Development. Huh? That's my new department, Instructional Leadership and Professional Development.
You have to write that down and hand to me.
I will do that. And may I add that E.R. Shipp doesn't know this, but she was a principal in my lectures many, many times on media criticism in my class when I taught media criticism due to her work as ombudsman at the Washington Post. And I want to say very favorably, in fact, because I thought she did an exceptional job.
Well, thank you very much.
Anyway, so you are a hero to two of our guests. Bob Swan, you're also one of his heroes. He's always mentioned that. He said you should have run for president of the United States when you were ombudsman.
Oh, no.
That's what he always said.
That's a curse, not a blessing.
So, and good to have you all here. Let's start real quick. And folks, join us here. And you really can bring any issue. Think of this as an open mic day and bring whatever issues you have to the table, as our guests will as well. We want to hear what you're thinking about all manner of things that are facing us, 410-319-8888. And let's just – where we left off yesterday in some ways was this conversation about what happened at Naval Shipyards. And President Barack Obama was on today talking about – yesterday talking about guns and need for gun control, at least for background checks to ensure that – guns don't fall into the hands of the mentally ill in this country to cause harm to other people. And I'm curious, especially as media and communications people, American studies people, looking at how we covered this, what this says to you and what you gleaned out of it. One thing that hit me very hard was seeing how the gunman himself sought help twice at the Veterans Hospital for hearing voices and didn't get the help. That's one thing that really struck out at me, as did the faces of the people who were murdered and looking like all of our neighbors. What struck you about the way – what we've gleaned from this media coverage and what we have not?
Well, so much of the media coverage was predictable. We fell back on various kinds of cliches about the gunman and about the responses to what happened that day. Let me be a little less vague. We were very quick, it seemed, in the media upon identifying this man to start raising questions about how he was able to get on the base, into the Naval Yard. And there were all these stories about his having stolen someone's ID and gotten on the base. So then that led to a slew of reports about how easy it is to steal ID, get onto bases, that kind of thing. That turned out not to be quite right. He was using his own identification. It was totally legit. So we went off on a tangent there. Then there was the whole notion of there must have been more than one person doing this. So a good bit of the coverage centered around trying to find one or two other people. I think one white male, one black male.
Right, right.
So we spent a good deal of time, and the people in the Navy Yard spent a lot of time on lockdown while authorities were looking for these mysterious people who did not exist. So that went into some crazy directions there too. Eventually, though, when it was determined who this person was, and that he had a military background, we started asking questions about post-traumatic stress disorder. And there were people speculating about that who did not exactly know what they were talking about. We now know that there are some mental health issues involved, but everything was just a mishmash of information, some of which was true and some of which was just filler for airtime. And too often we're doing that, I think.
So let me ask you that, just very quickly. That last sentence, filler for airtime. So here's this horrendous disaster, the fifth major shooting since Newtown that has taken place in this country. Fifth multiple shootings, becoming like a – we'll talk about this in a minute – like almost a regular happenstance in America that people almost – the ears and eyes begin to glaze over. It happens so much in our culture these days. We'll talk about that in a second. But when you said filler, so what is it about our media that we have to have filler? What would be done instead? I mean, you are actually having – I mean, you know, you've been a journalist for a long time. You've studied communications. You've been looking at this for a long time yourself, Kimberly. What is the alternative to the filler?
Well, I'll give you a response to that. In the rush to be first, to use a phrase, truth is always the first casualty. And if the reports by media were more and more tentative, that is, and this is beginning to happen a little bit, but it's not happening enough, where they would say that our first information indicates that this is tentatively what we have learned. It may not bear scrutiny, but this is what we apparently know at this time. If they had qualification after qualification when they're representing factual material, then I think you could there's always going to be the rush to be first. There's no way to stop that. But if you would have a little bit of humility and a little bit of tentativeness, you could always make the argument that what we're about to give you is that which we have now. None of this is confirmed. And never say something is confirmed before it's confirmed. That was a problem they had in predicting elections years ago. Mm-hmm. I think that you can come to a happy agreement as to how journalism should proceed in these matters.
This was a good news day for media. Because there was so much to talk about, so much to speculate on, and as Richard has said, without much information to substantiate it. And so I found much of the news coverage to be reactionary and sensational. But I also felt like it was doing exactly what we have seen about news media for a long time, and that is getting us as viewers to feed into the culture of fear. And that seems to be fairly consistent with much of any of the major events that do involve some level of violence in our country, that we help to massage it to a point where we're always on edge. And instead of waiting to actually allow the information to unfold so that we can give a level of accuracy, instead we continue to kind of fan the fire and participate in this fear culture that we want our viewers to participate in.
Well, we could. I don't think that media will now hold back and say we don't know anything. I wish they would do something like that. But in the rush to be first, they'll often go on the air, and we're seeking now broadcast, but it's also true for online media. You will also produce information just to produce the information. Here we have something. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to tell you anyway. In the old days, we like to think that the professional media people would be the filters. And so before we went on the air to say, well, I have a bunch of information here, we would actually sort it out a little bit. It's probably impossible now to wait for any length of time. But I do wish that we were a little bit more honest about what we know and what we don't know, and to be honest about the fear that we're creating unnecessarily, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we need to tone down some of what we sometimes just in the inflection when the reporters are on the air, there's this guy running loose and he's crazy and we don't know where he is and the helicopters are flying overhead and something is happening. We don't know what, but something is happening. That was kind of what I felt in seeing
right.
some of that coverage.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, some are better than others. I mean, you have, I always say at CNN, you have some of the best and worst reporting that I've ever seen. I mean, I'll just say that I think Wolf Blitzer is wonderful. I think he is always very responsible. I think some of the others are not so wonderful. And I do think that the iteration of qualifications and the iteration of the sources, that is, there's nothing wrong with saying that that Alexis had X level of discharge, even though that turned out to be incorrect, and our source for that is X. Why not say what the source is, how many sources you have, how reliable they've been in the past? They can't say we don't have time to do that.
I was going to say, that's what they're going to say.
Yeah,
because what you just said would take the 2 minutes that they were going to use
right.
for the report.
Well, Richard wants an academic journal.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen with the news, ever,
well,
with
right.
that amount of
and
sources.
And often the source is the other news operation, so they're not going to give credit to the other news operation.
Is there time since they repeat everything over and over and over again, and people have now, because we're so locked into our digital world, that we expect instantaneous information, and so we want to know what's happening at this very moment, what's going on now, you know, that we have to know. But is there time? What would happen if the media used some time for this introspection? Suppose you took a looked back at the other violent instances in America and what that meant, and brought people on who were kind of talking about that, to put that as part of the text, subtext of the conversation we're having. If media did that, if you brought,
but it's hard to do when media is a business, and so we've got to remember that as an industry, it is there to make money, and by virtue of that, some of the decisions that are being made of what to report, how to report, and how to be methodical about that reporting isn't necessarily going to happen because we do need to get that material out to the people and be first and make sure they have access to it as soon as possible.
And CNN wants to be ahead of Fox. And everybody wants to be ahead of MSNBC, which is trying to do something to show that it's still relevant. But everybody is trying to be the one that you go to in crisis. So they are going to go out there first and fast and all of that. But there are opportunities for the introspection that usually comes at the end of the day. So you will have a news analysis kind of program in the evenings on some of these shows. In the meantime, though, the nation is worried that we're, you know, under attack by crazy people who are storming military bases. Actually, one of the things I heard that day was that Mr. Alexis had some Muslim connections,
right,
and that he and what he was doing was in response to a general call that had gone out for people to do something on that day.
Right.
That was a story for a little bit.
And so by virtue of just interjecting the word terrorism, again, mm-hmm, we immediately
takes us to another level.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And we start responding to that fear.
But, you know, I don't find that media ever analyze themselves, ever, certainly empirically. They never go back over the years and say, when we had this crisis, here's what we did, and we were 75% correct or 67% correct. I mean, do you remember when Brian Williams on NBC played that self-serving tape by the perpetrator at Virginia Tech, Cho, and he said, boy, they got it on a Monday. They got the tape on a Monday, and it was only they who got the tape, and they played it on a Monday. And they said, boy, I'll tell you, we spent a lot of time thinking about this. We spent hours thinking to ourselves, do we want to play this? And then they play it, you know, the day they got it. And some people were criticizing them, and I was among them, as kind of promoting this sort of self-serving action and self-serving tape. And they have never, to my knowledge, gone back and argued whether that was a good idea. At the time, they said, this will help us identify such killers in the future. Now, I see by your smiles you agree. This never helps identify anybody in the future. But I would like to see some mea culpa by NBC, for example, to go back to their coverage on that and say whether they now regret having played that tape by Cho the first night following the Virginia Tech massacre.
That kind of conversation might be likely when NBC participates in some kind of academic conference. But they're not likely to go on Meet the Press or one of the programs such as that and say, let me tell you what we did, and now this is what we're going to do in the future. That probably won't happen.
But, and the other thing is, as Shipp said earlier regarding these filters, the filters aren't happening because now the people who are sitting before us, especially in broadcast media, are not filters, they're celebrities. And so much of what is tied to the information that's disseminated to us are coming from personalities that many of us as viewers have connected to, and not necessarily the knowledge base that they have to be able to share information with us. We like this person, so this is who we follow. This is who we listen to. So it's the personality, and it's very much disconnected from the actual information that needs to be disseminated to us.
An interesting email from somebody here. I'll just share it. Somebody's sister, who's a controller of the Navy, yesterday spent most of the day in a stairwell in the Navy Yards. What the press is not reporting is that just prior to the shooting, her office was informed that the Navy personnel records have been hacked into. That's why they are not allowed back into the building today. People didn't go home last night working on this. I find ourselves committed to different proposals on how life should work, yet we only have about, okay, so that was interesting. I don't know what that sidebar meant, but I'm interested to find out more about that. I think there are a lot of things going on that in this piece, what struck me the speculation of who he was, I kind of try to ignore that as much as humanly possible. You know, just like I did see the piece about the Muslim thing when actually he was somebody who, when he was in his right mind, was
Buddhist
and following Thai culture.
He was bingo.
Well, you know.
It's all abroad.
It's all someplace else. But I think that one of the things we talked about yesterday in this program was that that raises other issues. And one of the issues raises is the level of violence in America, why we have these five incidents like this, why they're becoming, seem to be, at least in this period of our time, becoming more frequent, the kind of violent episodes, mass violent episodes. And it raises questions about guns for people on both sides of that issue, and it raises issues around access to mental health in this country.
There are disputes as to whether it's more frequent or it's simply it
no,
seems
not,
more
there's
frequent.
There's nothing, no. There have been five major incidents like this since Newtown. That's not disputed.
Yeah, but there have been, what did they say, 67 incidents in the last 10 or 15 years. I'm not going to get into the debate as to whether empirically there have been more or less, but the perception that it's been on the increase, I think, may be simply a function of the most recent sorts of violence that have occurred. I don't know of any empirical evidence that we have an increasing number of such incidents.
Well, I can pull this up.
Okay.
I can read the list of 67 the last several years. It can also read the list of the five that happened since Newtown in this country.
But I think what your point is that we may be focusing on it more in media than perhaps in the past. So we don't know whether there were a lot of them that went unreported in the past. But now it's on our radar screen.
And it may not be an accident that with high profile reporting that you increase the number of such incidents. I mean, people. There is a motive to get publicity for. I mean, this guy. Look, I am not saying I know why Alexis did what he did, but one of the apparent pieces of evidence is that he had an argument with the VA hospital. You know, I don't know. You know, he felt he was being treated. He was being treated with diffidence. That he was being ignored. All of these things are possible. People feel when people do these sorts of things, they feel that they've been done some terrible injustice for which they have the right to act accordingly. That, boy, they could have listened to me. I told them over and over again, and they never listened to me. And now they're going to have to listen to me. And when they have to listen to me, people are going to report this, and they're going to make me a big deal, and I'm finally going to get the publicity I deserve.
So 410-319-8888 is the number here. And then we come back. Let's jump into this whole question of violence. I'm going to add to this. You know, there's a lot of violence happening in America. There's the violence. There's a lot of police violence happening in America. There's a lot of violence in our own communities happening in America. And let's touch on those and what the connections might be on this violence in our culture, because all of you look at that in the work that you do. 410-319-8888. We had callers calling in yesterday talking about, and want to hear from you again today, about what they think is increased violence in society, both in our communities and by the police, and what all that means. Stay with us. Jimi Hendrix, that was it. Greatest national anthem ever played in this country. Too bad we couldn't play more of it. Reminding you here on the Mark Steiner Show that WEAA's fall membership drive begins October the 12th through the 20th. And we need a lot of help in our pledge room, volunteers for the program and other programs. So to volunteer, please call 443-885-2075. That's 443-885-2075. Or go to weaa.org and sign up. We want you here. It's always a good time, good food, good fellowship, raising money for the station you love. So 443-885-2075, volunteer. And do it at 9 o'clock in the morning. Come join us here. I guarantee a good breakfast. Uh-oh, did I just say that? But I do. 443-885-2075.
And breakfast is real breakfast, right? Not croissants and coffee.
You don't like croissants yet?
I like breakfast.
So, me too. That's the voice of E.R. Shipp, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and journalist in residence and associate professor of journalism here at the Morgan State University School of Global Journalism. Kimberly Moffitt, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, assistant professor of American Studies at UMBC, author of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics in Africana Communities. Dr. Richard Vatz, professor in the Department of
Instructional Leadership and Professional Development
at Towson University, and blogs regularly for Red Maryland, a communist publication. No, I'm just kidding.
And I've written a book, the only authentic book of persuasion. I obviously haven't persuaded you to mention that frequently.
Because my producers didn't put it on my sheet.
So, there you go.
There you go. Let me just say immodestly, it is a great book.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us here, steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages or tweet us here at Mark Steiner. And folks, join us here, 410-319-8888. Because this question of violence pervades this country all the time.
Mark, let me make a statement which will upset your audience.
Well, I was about to ask Shipp to say about talk about North Carolina, but go ahead.
Yeah, but she won't upset your audience the way I can upset your audience. The people who get upset, and they should get upset, of course, about crimes like Alexis's crimes, and want to look at the mental health community to solve these problems.
I was going to go there, right? I was trying to talk about violence, but go ahead. Well, you're shifting in a different direction.
Well, but actually, this is quite relevant to the alleged prevention of violence.
Okay.
This is a worthless avenue to go down because they used to do studies of prediction of violence, and there has been, to my knowledge, no study that has ever shown that psychiatrists have a better ability to predict violence than anybody else, than non-professionals. And the notion that psychiatrists can predict or cure or solve somebody's violent tendencies requires somebody first to go see a psychiatrist to want to stop. Those kind of people generally don't commit violence. And the tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of people that commit these kinds of crimes are not going to get into the psychiatric community, and psychiatric community is not going to recognize them when they see them, and they're not going to do anything about it if they do see them. It is worthless.
Okay.
It makes people feel good, but it's worthless.
And you and I completely disagree on this.
No
way. Well, I don't.
Go ahead, Chip.
I don't have the background on this, but I do also have questions. When President Obama came out the other day and said that this Navy Yard incident made it more imperative for Congress to pass this legislation he's proposed.
On guns.
And he wants to, yes, anti-gun legislation. He wants to keep guns out of the hands of criminals and people with mental illness. I don't know what that means.
Me neither.
Exactly. What mental illness? A lot of us have mental illnesses that are not detectable by
or
the average person.
Yet.
Right. So I don't know what that means. And so, yes, we're going down the wrong path when we say the answer to violence is to get rid of people.
And
with
the National Institute
illness.
Of Mental Health estimates that 55% of Americans will be mentally ill during their lifetime, and that a majority of college-age students were mentally ill in any given year.
Well, see, let me just throw in this. I know, Rick, that you're a student of Thomas Sowers. You think there's a myth of mental illness, and we really disagree about this completely.
Not a myth of crazy behavior.
No. We disagree about even how to analyze it. I think you're right that a psychiatrist or anybody else is almost anybody is not going to be a great predictor of certain amounts of violence. But violence does pervade this country in some ways. And I think the question is why. I mean, I think that, you know, yeah, there are a few people who are going to act out in this kind of mass way, like happened just happened the other day. Well, one of the things we talked about in this program the other day when we talked about the legalization of drugs, and the comment was made that, and it's very true, the comment was made that if the police didn't spend all their time looking for marijuana under every bush and arresting people for heroin and putting them in jail, they might be able to address the epidemic of sexual and child abuse that takes place in this country every day, and really use investigative powers to do something. And to me, that's part of the violence of America. Part of the violence of America is this epidemic that we have of what happened to women and children in this country. What happens in the violence in our streets, our violent responses to everything that happens to us around us. And I think there is kind of, in some ways, this kind of. And mental illness is a different. It always kind of conjures up this. Conjures up the kind of wrong images. There are deep psychological problems people have for lots of reasons in America that have to be addressed, and we're not addressing them. This young man's was not addressed.
Right. And for me, when I think, I certainly don't ascribe to the myth of mental illness, but certainly when you think of someone like Alexis and many of our veterans, there's no way possible that we can imagine the human psyche having to experience what many soldiers may have to see, certainly in the time of war, and expect them to return home and all is well. I think there is a role that mental health professionals do play in assisting individuals and reacclimating them into a society that is not like the one they left when they were fighting on our behalf. So I do think there is an important role there. Does that mean it will address all of these situations? Absolutely not. It has nothing to do with the college student at Virginia Tech. It has nothing to do with Newtown. But there are ways that I think mental health professionals do assist us.
How? Tell me generally what good it does with respect to this horrible violence for people to say, yeah, well, if only psychiatrically this person had gotten some help. Tell me step by step.
Okay, that's really not fair.
Why not?
To say step by step, because nobody at the table is a psychologist.
No, but I'm not.
You can't say step by step. But what you can say is that is just because you can site studies on one side, and if we had time, we can go site studies on the other side.
Was in response to your earlier point to ask, then what are some of our steps to take? If we don't believe that mental health professionals or as an industry is assisting us in this role of addressing violence, then let's have a conversation of what else do we need to have at the
table. I'm glad you asked that. Because
instead of saying it doesn't work, get rid of it.
I'm glad you asked that because I've actually written on that question. What do we do? And my answer is I don't know.
Well, I think there is things that we need to talk about what we can do. I mean, you were talking a moment about before we went on the airship about the killing that took place in North Carolina. That's emblematic of the violence that takes place in America. You can tell that. I mean, talk a bit about that.
It is. I missed the story initially, and then I heard someone talking about it yesterday. This was a horrible incident in Charlotte where a young man had been involved in a car accident, had managed to crawl out from the car and seek help. The first house he reached was that of a white woman.
And he's black male.
A black male, a former football player, so we guess he's of some size. The woman became frightened when she saw him at the door, called the police. The police came. He then apparently started approaching the police, apparently seeking help. But one of the officers tried to use the taser on him, and that didn't work. So another officer fired off shots. I think he shot him 10 times.
Right, 10 times.
Killed the man.
Terrible.
Who was only seeking help. Yeah. Now the officer has been charged with voluntary manslaughter.
Right.
And there are all kinds of issues about the kind of training he had received and that other police officers are receiving when their first response seems to be to shoot, not to ask questions. And particularly in a situation involving whites and blacks. The officer was white. The woman who called the police was white. the young man was black. And we see these kinds of expressions of our fears all the time. And usually it comes out with the black person being the victim of the violence in this case. It was a tragedy that the family is now saying they're forgiving the officer. But they are still trying to seek justice.
Good. Yeah, it's a nauseating story. It's just incredible to me in this day and age that police would have such inadequate training that they would overreact like that. And it's despicable. And we agree on that.
I don't think it has anything to do with training, though. I think that's the cop out, that we're not dealing with the fact that we are all human beings that come to the table with baggage, with preconceived notions, with ways in which we look upon individuals. And in this instance, it was another black body that was also male. And all of the baggage that we have in terms of mediated representations about those bodies was a part of how police officers responded to him. And I don't think it would have been much different, in all honesty, had it been a black police officer, because
right.
Again, there is so much baggage many of us are carrying about those individuals that we react to it when we're in the moment instead of reflecting back on our training and saying this is what we're supposed
but
to do procedurally.
If it used to happen all the time and it doesn't happen all the time now, that
is
some difference.
It does happen all the time now.
It doesn't happen all the time like it used
Every
to happen.
Every 28 hours, a black man is killed by a security officer in America.
Where's that statistic from?
I can pull it up.
Every day?
28
wow.
hours.
Almost every day.
A person of color is shot by somebody who's a police officer or in security. Every 28 hours.
Person of color or black male?
Person of color. Every 28 hours.
I don't know what to say to that.
I know. I'm speechless.
There have been numbers of people who have been killed in Baltimore City this year, many of them questionable, whether it's the Arthur Anderson who was... And I asked the state's attorney who was on the show before, and I said, you know, if a human being is picked up and slammed to the ground and has five ribs cracked when they're thrown to the ground, that's not excessive force? How do you define excessive force? And when punctures his spleen and he dies, that's not – so what's excessive force? When another young man is kind of beaten and pummeled, and we don't know why he died, but he died after being beaten and pummeled by a number of policemen is that acceptable behavior on the part of somebody for a traffic stop? I mean, so these questions do have to be asked. I think, and then somebody called in and said, "Well, what about the fact that all these murders in the inner city, black on black crime, that's real too, mm-hmm. and it has to be." I mean, the almost 50, according to the FBI reports, almost 50% of the murders in America are black folks killing black folks, and
we need to address
all of that.
But sometimes it seems that we choose what to focus on. So some people will focus on white cops killing black males, but won't do much about the other issues of black on black. We need to address all of it.
Absolutely.
We need to say that all human life has value.
Right.
And we need to do what we need to do to preserve that value. That it goes beyond violence, obvious violence. It goes into other things like yep. quality of life
right.
issues in general, doesn't it?
But there's so much that does seem to reiterate the message to us that there are some bodies that are more expendable than others. And that's the frightening part, because that starts to impact even you as the, you know, journalist who knows better. It starts to impact your psyche in terms of what does this then mean for the young black men that I am affiliated with or attached to. And that is more of a concern, in my opinion, than...
Let me open the phone to you. Just as a caller came in, I was hoping we'd get to. And if you get to jump back in, Dr. Carter, we'll have you back on, because I think he wanted to talk a bit about veterans and psychosocial issues and what happens to veterans. And you're smiling, Vats, but people who go through war, you have no idea what people go
Absolutely.
Through.
I'm smiling because I'm a nice person.
Is that right? Okay, I got you. You are a nice person. You are a nice person. But I mean...
I always smile. I'm not smiling in derision.
I got you. I apologize.
That's right.
So let's go to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Sheila, you're on the air.
Mark, this is Sheila Evelyn. How are you?
Well, welcome.
Okay. I wanted to make a comment specifically with regard to the mental health issue and access to care. And I do feel like, you know, I don't want it to be personalized by your guest, because I'm not saying he's a bad practitioner or anything of that nature. But my comment specifically is to the access of mental health care benefits. Even when insured, it is very difficult to obtain mental health care in certain plans, most plans actually, because you have preferred providers or people that you're required to see. My experience within the last year, because I am a nurse and I do refer people, et cetera, is that most people who were members of plans were not accepting new patients. So in certain cases, it caused tremendous delay for patients to receive appropriate care, because most people don't have the resources to pay $200 or $300 an hour for psychiatric care out of pocket. They depend on their insurance.
Right.
That's one aspect of it. The next aspect of it is, even though there are privacy laws, if someone is deemed to be a threat, those privacy laws can be set aside. I don't understand why that is not done more often if someone really does pose a threat. The next issue
we have a lot of callers, so Sheila, but go ahead. Finish this last thought.
The next aspect of it is, you know, you have background checks and you are supposed to be checking for people with mental illness. But if someone is actually in the mental health care system and they own weapons, what is going to be the mechanism to make sure that that is brought to the attention of whomever?
So you're against the HIPAA protections.
But
you're against the HIPAA protections.
No, she's questioning.
HIPAA can be set aside if someone is considered to be a threat. And if you are actively psychotic, if you are experiencing significant paranoia, that serves as enough potential to, yes, set aside HIPAA and notify whomever to obtain weapons.
Absolutely.
Case in point, approximately 15 years ago or so, Owen Sweeney came to the door of a house in Hamilton, Maryland, because there was a schizophrenic patient off of his medication. He had a shotgun in the house, and he shot through the door and killed the officer.
Right.
Now, if I were a member of that household, you know, the statement was, "Oh, I didn't remember."
Sure, we really have to. I have to ask you to wrap up the thought. I'm sorry.
Okay. I want to know what can be done. I mean, there has to be a plan, and something has to be put into effect. And if you make guns disappear tomorrow, I don't know if that's going to work.
All right, Sheila, thank you. Let me just get one more call in here that kind of reflects on this, and we'll jump into the conversation. Let's go to line one, Eugene, who's talking about vets and mental health care.
Am I on?
You're on.
Okay. I'm a veteran. I've been in the Korean War and also the Vietnam War. And I've seen veterans in which nobody in the armed forces, this government, is not addressing this problem ever since 1954. This is the problem. Veterans go to war and kill people who they don't know. I've been trained to do the same thing as all veterans in war. You can't argue with that. The point is this, these are normal people, and some of them are really abnormal, but the point is this, they go in, try to defend the country, they're trained to kill people. Some it's easy to do, some it's difficult to do. And the point is this, you have problems from that result. Now, once the war, their time is over, they're automatically shoved back into the society in which they came from. But instead of holding these veterans over and putting them through a program to detoxify the ignorance of all this killings that they have been trained for, the services do not do that. The president should address this. He's the commander of all the armies. He should know that. The point is this. They're back in society, untoxified, and what happens? They get on jobs that our people have never been trained in the service. They don't know how veterans feel. They've never been to war. And what happens? They get this mentality of forcing and forcing and access. Well, this brings up the whole thing with the veteran. He's excited, and there you go. You got your chaos.
Eugene, I appreciate the call, Eugene. I think that what you're saying is important. We hear this from a lot of veterans, and the story is a real one. And I think that, I mean, that's part of the issue. We don't know what happened to this fellow in shipyards or anybody else. And trauma of war, trauma that people go through living in the violence of certain communities, trauma in people's homes leads to mental instability, leads to what you deny that exists, which is mental illness. And I think that there is, I mean, there's very little access in this country.
Let's not get on the nomenclature here. I mean, I don't deny that violent behavior is rife in our society. Parenthetically, I would like to know, was this the case after World War II?
Yes, it was.
Was there violence to this extent after World War II?
There was a lot of violence after World War II, and a lot of veterans. There was a lot of domestic violence after World War II. Mm. There was a lot of violence towards children after World War II. There was a lot of
institutional violence. Were there attacks? Were there mass murders?
Well, there wasn't the access to guns after World War II, too. We didn't have this kind of universal access to guns after World War II that we have now. We don't have the NRA and the arms industry pushing guns on society like we have now. It didn't exist before that.
Well, people did in the past have guns. That was part of your daily life if you were in a more rural America.
And in the South.
And in the South, too. So it's not that we didn't have access to guns. Somehow our attitude towards human life and human values have seemed to have changed. We're talking about this because, I suppose, of the shooting at the Navy Yard. But the Mr. Alexis, the man who was the shooter, we are now saying he had mental illnesses and that he sought help. But he sought help for insomnia. So even if he had been treated for insomnia, that would not necessarily have prevented him from shooting up the Navy Yard. I don't know how you would have, to get back to your point, how would you have detected
that may not have.
From his coming to seek help for insomnia?
But what about the incident in Rhode Island?
We now know that he called the police saying that somebody, he was hearing voices essentially.
Right. And supposedly Newport, Rhode Island police also relayed that information to the Navy. But the story stops there in terms of what actually transpired.
Yeah, the question of the security problems is separate, of course.
The military is notorious not taking care of any mental health issues at all. Notorious.
But I was going to say, if the police contacted somebody, it would have been at such a low level to say that a guy who was in the Navy is hearing voices. I don't know that ever would have gotten into any records that would have alerted anybody. It just happened last month.
And hearing voices does not correlate, as people think it does, with violent behavior.
No, it does not.
No.
Yeah. No, it does not.
Or we would all be acting on violence.
I agree with that. And so is my friend who's talking to me here.
My friend is the same thing. And I think that in the military, you're stigmatized if you go to seek counseling for any issues you may face.
Not
depression,
just in the military.
No, I know, but it's really stigmatized. But it's stigmatized everywhere. But we're out of time for this. This has been a really interesting discussion. I appreciate the three of you for joining us today. As always, E.R. Shipp, thank you. Glad you're here at Morgan State University.
Well, thank you.
Kimberly Moffitt, always good to see you. Thank
Absolutely.
You so much. From UMBC, Rick Vetch, Towson State, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
We're going to take a brief break, and it's that time of the month again. Leah Gilmore is in the house. Stay with us. Don't go away.
Kind of hurry. Don't waste all the film there. Stop it for a second. Because I was scared to death. So then, can I just do it one more time, though? Can I just do it one more time? Mm-hmm.